like for myself, the only thing I had was that code, what's called a TC-150 code that basically puts me as having income from the Virgin Islands. Most people will have that because that 1040 return is a Virgin Island form. It's a Virgin Island taxpayer form. And I actually have a letter from the IRS via their own manual saying so. So most people will have that TC-150 code on there. And as far as these other business exotic business codes, like I know a guy who has being listed as selling foreign insurance or being a pistol and revolver manufacturer or diesel fuel. Those are all excise taxable activities. I mean, you could be here. That could be here in the United States. You don't have to. They don't have to have you having residing in Virgin Islands or Cayman Islands for the those type of things like diesel fuel, because those are excise taxes, and we do have valid excise tax laws that must be paid. And if they have you listed as those, then you know, that's what they're.
So that is their keystone or key point of being able to have jurisdiction over us is saying that we're residents of the Virgin Islands or we're dealing with liquor or firearms and so forth. Is that the basic approach?
That's correct. And they don't. If it went to court, I mean, people are probably wondering, well, wait a second, that would be pretty easy to prove. I mean, if they're saying you're involved with that. Alcohol, tobacco, firearms, or pistol manufacturers. I mean, that's what I thought. When I first heard about this, I said, oh, God, I'd be pretty easy to prove that I'm not doing that, like if I'm a teacher or a lawyer. But they don't show that to the court. I mean, these are all in codes, and they don't they don't talk about that as far as their liability.
Well, certainly, that would spill the whole business
right.
at all. And,
right.
And so if they do have a file and they do take it to the court, it's probably hidden in all these codes. And if you don't have a code translator, then you wouldn't be able to reveal their whole approach.
Yeah, well, that's the whole purpose of my service. And if people want to kind of look at what I've done and do some research on what the individual master file is all about, and having the availability of federal lawyers and paralegals to get access to the file to see what IRS lists you as, you can go to my website, which is www.taxfreedom.net. And there's actually some examples on there about the, there's actually an IMF on there, an example of that. So that's taxfreedom.net. And, basically, the whole purpose of that, putting those codes in there, just allows them to investigate, allows them to do those liens and levies, and it allows them to come after you. They have to do that because the criminal investigation IRS has no authority of citizens for income taxes who are residing within the 50 states. So that's why they have to do these false codes.
That's really extraordinary. So that is their whole legal lever, if you will, to obtain jurisdiction over the average person.
And that's why I'll never file a 1040 again, because that's what they do. That's what happens when you file 1040s. You basically assess yourself, and they thank you for it. And
yeah, and you're basically when you do that, you're saying that yes, I'm indeed a dealer in firearms, or I'm a resident of the Virgin Islands, or I'm running a foreign corporation or whatever here in the United States. And as you say, when you sign your name at the bottom of the page there, it's like prima facie evidence. You're saying, I'm a liquor dealer, and so I'm under the jurisdiction. It's a tremendous fraud that's being perpetuated here. Just tremendous. And I just hope that more and more people start to realize what's going on and that we can really change the system. You're right about the numbers of the people that are just, I think that have dropped off the rules, and the, you know, that's not a good way to run a country. We should have a system where people will be glad to pay their taxes because, one, it's an honest way of taxing people, and they understand it, and it's fair. And not only that, but it's going to good purposes. But the kind of system we have is just absolutely crazy here. Well, Jason, we're getting pretty near the end of the program. Maybe you give your phone number and website out one more time. We just have like 20 seconds.
Sure. Again, my phone number is area code 831-763-1947. And my website is www.taxfreedom.net.
Thank you very much. And folks, look into this stuff. It is extraordinary.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But right now, of course, we are waiting for our guests to come on. And let's see if we're having any difficulty getting Dr. Joe Douglas. Perhaps our producer could come in here, and I'll give him the address so he can give him a call, make sure we've got... or maybe we can send him a fax right now. He seems to be hooked up to a fax line, so... I'll ask our producer to call Barbara and see if she can. We can set up. Right now, we're in the process of trying to get our special guest on. So at this point, let me simply point out that there are a lot of unusual things that are happening, and we certainly wish we had an explanation for them. One of them, as I've commented before, the war began. It was very, very obvious, you know, when. George Bush gave an ultimatum to Iraq that Saddam Hussein would have to leave the country or we were going to attack, that Saddam, if he'd been very, very smart, and if he'd been truly the evil person that we have been led to believe, that he would take $1 billion or $2 and find some country that would give him security, and he would just have taken off and left Iraq. It said that he was prepared to leave Iraq during the first Gulf War if it looked like he was going to be overthrown. And yet faced with almost certain death if he stayed, Saddam Hussein did not agree to leave the country and save his people from the tragedy of war. So then, of course, as we watch the progress of the war. Now, if you imagine that you were in charge of the Iraqi military, and you knew that America was going to come in with tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles and trucks, supply trucks, why, you'd think that you would block the roads. You'd blow up the roads, you'd mine the roads, so that, people would be, trucks and tanks would be coming along the roads, and they'd be destroyed, they'd be slowed down. You'd think that you'd destroy the major bridges there. You'd think that you would set all of the oil companies on fire, all of the oil wells on fire. You would probably blow up some of the dams to flood the area. You'd certainly mine the Euphrates River and put things in it so it couldn't be used for transportation. You'd blow up the airports. And none of these things were done. It was almost exactly as if this was being done intentionally. Well, right now, we have with us on the line Dr. Joe Douglas. Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, let's see now. Of course, you've been studying this national security the report that was put out some time ago, even before the war. What was this all about? Why is that important?
Well, this was the national security strategy that is by law issued every year.
And now, when was this specific edition of it issued that we're talking
this
about
today? This particular issue came out in the middle of September in 2002.
All right, fine.
And it's particularly different from all the other ones because it is a brand new approach. It is the first one following 9/11, and it took an entirely different tact. It was not just a revision of the prior ones or a rubber stamp of the prior ones or update. It's a completely redone national security strategy and is basically sets forth the blueprint for the war on terrorism.
Right. Well, of course, we were involved in the war on terrorism. So how are we going to fight terrorism as of September of last year?
Well, what is interesting in this document is that the war on terrorism actually seems to take a back seat to a whole raft of other activities. It has some information on the war on terrorism, which is focused toward Iraq, but the majority of it really is focused on spreading basically a free trade and free markets and democracy and open societies around the world. So it is really an opportunity, and it actually states that, an opportunity that we intend to capitalize on to do all these things under the name of the war on terrorism.
Well, it really sounds to me like the war on terrorism would be an effort to create this new world order that they talk about with democracy and free trade and all of these things, to break down national boundaries and establish this one world government that the leaders of this country and certain other world leaders really want. And certainly one of the things that it should be very obvious to everybody is that Saddam Hussein and the leaders of Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia and most of the Muslim countries really don't want a world government. They don't want to give up their power. And the only way that you can get them to give up their power would be simply to replace them with leaders that we could control who'd go along with our agenda, which is really all about a new world order and a new world religion. It really has nothing at all to do with being concerned about weapons of mass destruction, but it has to do with this internationalist vision, which has been the dominant force of American foreign policy going back to the days of the Spanish-American War.
That was certainly my conclusion upon reading it. I felt the same way, that this is really a way of jumping on a war and furthering the New World Order. And, you know, it brings to mind that piece that was identified by Norman Dodd's assistant back about 50 years ago when she was going through the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation, and they were several years discussing whether or not there was any more effective way to achieve change than to do so under the guise of war. And they concluded that no, the best way to achieve change was to do it when there was a war going on.
Well, you know, that's
that just preceded the First World War.
For our listeners out there, if any of you would like to hear my interview with Norman Dodd, it's available on our four-tape set on the secret government. And I actually interviewed Mr. Norman Dodd, and he told that story about sending Catherine Casey to go through the records of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And, of course, where they actually were spent the year 1908 to 1909 saying, how can we bring about world peace? Well, how can we change the world? Well, the best way is with war. And then 1909 to 1910 determining how they would create a war and get us involved. And for any of these skeptics out there, we have a copy, and it's in our new syllabus on Iraq, The Untold Story. And it's available through our ministry. The syllabus actually contains some pages from the Journal of American History, the fall edition, 1908, talking about the fact that a great war is coming, and it would be followed by United Nations. And it actually talks about the United Nations. In fact, we have the complete draft of the Constitution of the United Nations that was drawn up in 1908. We don't include it in the in that syllabus, but anybody who wants it, we do have that available. And we certainly know that even in 1906, Bertrand Russell, in his autobiography, tells about a little organization he belonged to called the Coefficients. And in 1906, they were planning on the First World War. So all of these wars were planned long ahead of time, but of course you could never let the people know that.
Absolutely correct. And this entire national security document just reads in that that manner. It has all these actions set out, which are clearly all of them representing a tremendous change in the culture of other countries, most specifically the Middle East. It indicates that we intend to spread these free markets and free trade, which, of course, is itself a deception. The markets aren't free. They're manipulated markets. That we intend to get rid of repressive governments and introduce ones that are democratic and that where there's respect for women and tolerance for different types of religions, and to open the societies to views from the outside. Of course, these are all directed toward countries, but mainly the Middle East, to have a total change in their internal society, in their culture, and of a nature that it would seem to me that every single government in the Middle East would rise up in arms against them, or certainly recognize what it meant, and would even perhaps start sending people into Iraq to help with that battle, while being very careful to concerning how well the Americans were doing. Right now, I suspect they're really trying to figure out how to stop the Americans, because it looks like they may have now taken out Saddam and his sons and top command structure, and that will pretty well bring the war, I suspect, to more or less an end, except for the remaining snipers and irregular forces that continue to operate.
Well, you know, of course, they're talking about leaving somewhere between 7,500 and 200,000 American troops permanently scheduled over there in Iraq. Now, of course, I heard Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld saying today, we're only going to have our boys there for 36 months. In 36 months, they'll come home. But then, of course, that's what Bill Clinton said about our troops in Bosnia about 5 years ago. They'll be home by November. He just didn't say November of what year.
Well, that, of course, is to the, that's also the 7,000 or so. We're certainly going to keep probably all the 250 or 300,000 there over the next at least 6 months, which is the time to get a rudimentary government established there, according to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. But what are we going to do then? Do we really intend to move those forces out, having moved them all the way over there, or will it be then a case of attacking Iran or Syria?
Or perhaps Saudi Arabia. The thing is that, you know, we took our troops into Germany during the Second World War, and our troops are still in Germany 55 years later. Left our troops in Japan for 55 years and in South Korea for 55 years. And does anybody honestly believe that after we've conquered Iraq, that we're going to pull our troops out of there, no matter what they tell us? I mean, they're going to tell us what we want to hear. But what indeed is the truth? And I believe that those troops are going to be there. And anybody who doubts that, I know you're well acquainted with that publication of the Project for a New American Democracy called Rebuilding America's Defenses, aren't you?
Somewhat, yes.
All right. And basically in that it says that we have an obligation to keep our troops. We want to keep our troops there, American troops stationed in the Middle East. And this transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. In other words, it doesn't matter what Saddam Hussein's there or not. We want to keep a permanent American troop presence in the Middle East. That's what it's really all about. But the average American, you know, he doesn't want to dominate the world. He doesn't want to give up his freedom and his sovereignty to this New World Order concept. So we're not going to tell the American people what we're really up to, although the evidence is certainly all out there in the national security strategy, in the publications of the Project for a New American Century. This all was planned long, long, long before the attack on the World Trade Center. In fact, it was so convenient that that came along, because if it hadn't come along, how would they ever have gotten the American people to go along with their agenda?
That's true. And, of course, one of the key items for establishing the New World Order is energy security. And that's namely, that means oil. And, of course, that's one of the key reasons that many people believe we went into Iraq for reasons of maintaining oil security there and of bringing online a lot more oil production to satisfy the demands which would be coming out of China as they continue to develop and increase their industrial production.
Well, you know, you're right back there in Washington, D.C., and for our listeners who don't know, Dr. Douglas has been back in the Washington, D.C. area for many years. He's have you actually worked with government in the past?
Yes, I have. I was back in the Defense Department for a few years back in the early 1970s.
Okay. And so you still have connections with people in positions of government. What's the very basic attitude of people back there? Of course, everybody's glad that the war is going so well, and certainly we've had a minimal loss of life considering the enormity of what's happened. In fact, so many of the men that we've lost have actually been lost as a result of friendly fire. But, you know, with less than 100 casualties or men killed to date, this is truly an amazing accomplishment. So what is the attitude of the people back there? Do they understand the implications of the transformation of American foreign policy from being dedicated to preservation of freedom here at home to becoming a world empire? Because this is really what they're calling for.
The people who recognize it most, I think, are probably the military. The feeling I have is that the Pentagon, the military and the Pentagon, are very much opposed to the war. They felt it was not a place for the United States to be, particularly in the Middle East, particularly in a place where you're in a very hostile area. You don't have any friends over there, truly. And the military has been generally against this war, I would say. Certainly the civilian leadership in the Pentagon is very much for it. One of the things that really bothers me about this is this whole idea of establishing democracy. And, you know, When you think of it, I was looking at an article in one of the magazines about 3 or 4 days ago, and it went over the governments in the Middle East. And what was surprising was there were a few monarchies, but most of the governments there were listed as republics.
Republics?
As republics.
What government in the Middle East would be considered a republic?
Well, for one, Iraq.
Iraq would be a republic.
Now, see, that brings up a question, which is, what difference does it matter what you call something, whether it's a democracy or a republic or something else? You know, back in 1986, I believe it was, I remember when the Soviet Union came out with a new constitution. And a number of my Sovietologist friends read it through very carefully, and they said, you know, this is more democratic than our own constitution. And, of course, we all had a joke at that because we all knew that it didn't mean anything because it was far from a democratic country. Of course, that's part of the problem. The Constitution, whether it's a democracy or a republic, doesn't make too much difference. the Constitution basically is not worth the paper it's written on unless you have a people who are morally and ethically capable of carrying it out. And it's that moral basis of the population which is what really is important and what made the Constitution of the United States mean something.
That's
if you don't have that type of a cultural background, whether something is a democracy or a monarchy or a republic or just plain dictatorship, it's going to be taken over by people within the culture, just as Saddam Hussein did after 1978 when he took power there, and turned it into whatever he desires to turn it into.
And our leaders call that a republic? I mean, what they're doing, of course, is playing games. America was a republic with limited power in the central authority and diffusion of power down to the state and local government, where matters dealing with life, liberty, and property were never to be dealt with by the federal government. There was never to be a federal Gestapo or federal police force. That was what a republic was all about. And now, of course, they want to convince the American people we're a democracy. And, of course, democracies always eventually become dictatorships. And so they're using that term, republic for Saddam Hussein and his authoritarian society, is only designed intentionally to confuse the American people about the very essence of what America was all about. Did you have that feeling, Dr.?
Oh, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. There's so many things about this war that are just very deceptive, very misleading, and designed for propaganda to the American public to mislead everybody about what's happening and what the causes of the war are.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Douglas, and we'll welcome your calls after we get back from this short break right here at the American at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest is Dr. Joseph Douglas, and we're talking about, of course, what's going on in the Middle East and about the national security strategy, which, of course, is the basis of American foreign policy, that nobody ever tells the American people what's really going on. In fact, President Bush had given a speech in February of this year before the American Enterprise Group, and, of course, 20 people came from the American Enterprise Institute. AEI and are now in his cabinet, the president's cabinet, and people like Dick Cheney and many others. Paul Wolfowitz comes from this little group, but they're also part of this project for the New American Century Group, a group that has an agenda, and that agenda is a world empire, the New World Order, and of course with that the New World Religion. And, of course, they've put out the National Security Strategy, the President's speech to the AEI in February. None of this gets to the American people. We're being told, oh, the war is being fought because, of course, Saddam Hussein is a wicked man, and there's no question he is. We're, of course, have to go to war because Saddam Hussein used poison gas on the Iranians, but everybody's forgotten we backed him. We continued to finance him. We gave him countless billions of dollars after he had used that gas on the Iranians. But you see, we never tell the American people that. So there's obviously another reason behind the war. And, of course, if you begin looking behind that, why you come to the conclusion it's oil? Or it is to protect the dollar so that the Arab countries don't begin using the euro as the reserve currency of the world. Or perhaps it's to defend Israel. And that those three explanations, each one has a great deal to be said for it, but none of them, in my estimation, are the real reason, because once you get behind all of those, you find out it's all about empire, about a new world order, a new world religion. So why don't you pick up the thought from there, Dr. Douglas?
Well, I think you're right. It's all about power and money, and that's what the new world order is about. And of course, the new world order itself is global socialism, although no one would call it that because that would frighten people away.
But, you know, socialism they're talking about is not a socialism where, of course, they redistribute the wealth of the everybody. It's simply an authoritarian system with a ruling elite, and then they just redistribute the wealth of the middle class.
That's true. As a matter of fact, in this idea of distributing wealth, I ran into an article that had something mentioned in it that was very disturbing, and that's a new cabinet position about to be proposed. which is going to be the Department of Foreign Aid. And if you want to look at something for redistributing wealth and another effort to steal the wealth of the United States taxpayers, it is foreign aid, which is certainly not something that was ever conceived of in our Constitution. But that's the way we're headed. It's strange because when you you look at this national security strategy and you see all these different aspects that are saying why democracy is so wonderful, and it's based on our model, and we have such things as a private property and free markets and free trade and freedom of speech. And when you look at it, it's all a mirage. Private property is being stolen right and left by environmentalists, and especially by taxes, which go into such things as foreign aid, which mainly feed the coffers of international organized crime.
Now, we're going to have to interrupt you because we're going to have to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back in just a few seconds. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is Dr. Joseph Douglas is with us, and you were just saying how foreign aid is used to actually finance organized crime. And in what way is that?
Well, foreign aid generally has gone to people who are at the top of the government, not to the people. Even food supplies, when you buy those and you ship them off to the country, more often than not, they're taken by the government and then sold on the open market. Money taken goes into the coffers of the top people in the government. And this idea of their requisitioning of foreign resources and foreign aid and things of that nature are a major portion of organized crime.
And of course, we've seen this when we've supplied massive foreign aid to the North Korean government in the name of humanity. And what we're really doing is keeping the brutal dictatorship there in power. And people have forgotten that we were the largest source of humanitarian aid for the Taliban in Afghanistan before we set out to kill them all. In other words, we were financing the best enemy that money could buy. But people, you never put one and one together. Why would you do something like that? The Taliban were ruthless as far as their imposition of Muslim law. They were certainly totally ruthless as far as their treatment of women was concerned, and yet we were financing that government right up until the September 11th attack, and then shortly thereafter we were at war with the government that we'd been financing for the previous 6 or 7 years. So there's something wrong with this whole picture.
Oh yes, and you can take the even before that and look at the Soviet Union itself and all the financing that went on to the Soviet Union in terms of loans, in terms of the use of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to send money, which comes from the United States, to the Soviet Union. And we were basically, again, there sending money by the billions of dollars to what was and still is one of our most lethal enemies.
Yeah, when you say still is, you mean you don't believe that communism is dead, as the media would have us believe?
Well, I think the thing I like to point out here is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, we'll say, and you had all these countries now free, like Czechoslovakia and Romania and Bulgaria and all the Lithuania and Latvia, the various republics, we've noticed two things. Number one, we still had the communists in control, and number two, we had a lot of the original culture start to emerge, which is why you have these re-emergent conflicts, say, in the state of Yugoslavia. The culture was never really killed within these countries. Yet we expect that suddenly the Russian culture is going to be totally changed. And that's absurd, especially when you still have the communists in control of Russia just as they were before. They've changed the label. Have the people changed? Hardly.
Well, the great tragedy is the fact that they've been able to convince the American people that communism is dead, and yet in Russia today, the secret police is still the KGB. They may have changed its name. The military is still under the control of the communists. The Duma is still under the control of the communists. The only thing they've done is been able to convince the American taxpayers we should funnel billions and billions of dollars over there under one guise or another. Oh, they've got chemical weapons. They just don't have enough money to destroy them. Give us a few billion dollars. Oh, we've got these old missiles. They've got to be dismantled. Give us a few billion dollars here, there, or elsewhere, you know, and invest your money in our corporations. We are building up, as we have for the last 70 years, 80 years, are the best enemy money can buy. Because Russia is in full military production for war, and we're not talking about their army. Their army may be a basket case, but they're certainly their strategic missiles are not. And they're launching new nuclear submarines all the time, and yet we've still got to keep giving them money. If they can afford to launch new nuclear submarines, why can't they pay all their expenses? Oh, we're just so poor. We just you've got to finance our scientists, or they're going to go over to Iraq and teach them how to build nuclear weapons. And the American people, gullible as they are, never understand that behind everything that's being said is this treachery, as we, of course, continue to build up the best enemy money can buy. Because if we didn't have the enemy, how could we convince the American people they have to put out all the money and taxes to protect us from that enemy?
That's true. And, you know, one of it reminds me to go back and take a look at the United Nations, which had all these wonderful resolutions that we are evidently assigned to police for them. But when you look at the United Nations and you ask, well, who really founded it? Who started the United Nations? And when you look at it, you see that it was a cooperative venture. On one hand, you have it basically being organized by the CFR, which is the secret establishment, if you will. And on the other hand, you see that most of the participants in the process, many of which were also on the CFR, were actually communists. So, you know, who does really the UN benefit? Who was it set up to benefit?
The ruling elite.
Well, the New World Order and the communists.
We'll be back here in just a moment here. With our special guest, Dr. Joe Douglas, and welcome your calls from out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. Joe Douglas, and he lives back in Virginia, Washington, D.C. area, and certainly one of our favorite guests. If you have never read his books, Red Cocaine, or his most recent one, which we carry, called Betrayed, it's the story of what happened to the prisoners of war. We abandoned after the First World War, after the Second World War, after Korea, and after Vietnam. And if there's one book you need to read to understand the fate of young men who went overseas to fight for freedom, thinking they were protecting America, you need to get Dr. Douglas's book, Betrayed. It's one of the most powerful and gripping stories you'll ever read. Well, we're talking right now, of course, the background of the United Nations. And, of course, the United Nations was established to become the one world government. It was to be the successor of the League of Nations, which failed after the First World War. And the First World War was organized and fought to bring about this world government, because only out of the chaos of war would they be able to bring about the change of society and create a world government. And when that failed, why, of course, they set out to create the Second World War. And if you doubt that this was planned long ahead of time, you need to get H.G. Wells' little book, The Shape of Things to Come, where in 1933 he was telling about how basically the Second Triad World Order would come about as a result of this conflict that would occur between Poland and Great Britain in 1939. And we have copies of his book. That's exactly what it says. And then, of course, he said the Third Triad, the New World Order, would come about as a result of a conference that would be held in Basra in Iraq in about 1988. Well, he was a little off in his timing, but you see, the whole idea was the Third World War, this Third Triad creating the New World Order, would come about because of an event that would occur in Iraq. And gee, isn't it interesting that the 70 years from 1933 to year 2003, 70 years later, long after H.G. Wells had died, the things he was talking about are coming to pass right in our very lives. So there's no question that all of this is planned, and the ultimate goal, of course, is not the preservation of freedom, not the preservation of our republican form of government, a nation created under God, and as John Adams said, our form of government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not suffice for any other. but of course to replace that with this authoritarian structure. And that's what socialism really is a ruling elite. And then, of course, everybody else controlled is simply a serf, because there is never any communism in Russia. There's always a ruling elite system. There's no communism in China. That government we installed there, and believe me, we did install that Chinese communist government in 1950 because we put an arms embargo on General Chiang Kai-shek so he couldn't buy weapons anywhere in the world. And, of course, after 2.5 years without weapons or supplies, why, of course, he had to simply evacuate his forces from the mainland to Formosa, or what we today call Taiwan. And, of course, we turned China over to the communists. And, of course, the great tragedy of most Americans do not understand that all of this was part of this effort to bring about this this world society that the people have cherished, this idea, this dream of a ruling elite who would ultimately rule the world. And people say, well, how could this go on? I mean, most of those people are long since dead. That's true. But the idea that energized them is not dead. It is still there. And I believe we are, of course, creating a world government for the prince of this world to rule, because behind this whole movement is powerful spiritual forces. And, of course, the ruler of this world has always been, as it was in the time of our Lord, the prince of this world, the devil himself. So why don't you pick up the story there from Dr. Douglas?
Well, I think the thing that we have to look at right now is what's going to happen after this this war in Iraq tapers off, and it's in the process of doing that, or certainly appears to be doing that. Now, if you think back a few weeks, probably about, I'd say, 4 or 5 weeks, just before we started this war, there was a big flurry in the news. And what they were showing us all the pictures of at that time was a whole new effort well underway by Iran, which would enable them to produce weapons-grade nuclear material for atomic bombs. And this would be producing a minimum of enough for several bombs each year. And the material, the whole plants were rebuilt. They were being set up at an isolated facility in Iran, and all the parts were being assembled for the refinement of the material. Now, there's no way that we can or would walk away from the Middle East with all the deployments we have over there when suddenly you have Iran, which has all the qualifications that Iraq had in terms of a repressive regime, a very closed society, no respect for women, and they're not only a number one terrorist state and sponsorship of terrorists, but also are constructing weapons of mass destruction. So it almost seems that inevitable that the stage is set to go into Iran and set in such a way that it's hard to see how we could even leave the area without going in there, since Iran actually is a much worse threat than Iraq ever was, although Iraq was just as bad a threat to its own people. But it didn't have half the sponsorship of international terrorism that Iran had, or Syria for that matter.
And I really think that's such an important point. Basically, one has only to read the writings of Joseph Badansky, who is the chairman of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, and specifically his book, Attack America, 1993, Bin Laden, the man who declared war against America. I think about 1999, his latest book, The High Cost of Peace. And he points out, you know, that the Iranians have nuclear weapons. They actually have them today. They have the chemical and biological weapons. They have an army three times the same size of Saddam's. And they really were financing Osama bin Laden, working with the Saudi Arabians to finance the Al-Qaeda and this whole movement, much more so than anything Saddam Hussein ever did. But they haven't told the American people that. I think that that's down the line, of course. We're going to find out exactly what you say. And that is that Iran, if not the next target, was be soon after that.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you can't let Saudi Arabia continue to do what it's been doing, not only because of the sponsorship of terrorism they've been doing, but also their sponsorship of radical Islam, which is Saudi Arabia is the main source for that, particularly for the recruitment of people and teaching them the radical theology here in the United States. On top of that, there is enough dissatisfaction with the royal family in Saudi Arabia that it's a primary target for destabilization. So for all these reasons, you have to really go into Saudi Arabia, because you cannot afford to have that region become destabilized, because it provides so much energy that the New World Order depends upon. So we have the whole Middle East basically being targeted here, and of course with Iraq being the stepping stone. And so we, about a few days ago, Jim Woolsey, the former director of the CIA, was getting an interview, and he talked about this war, and it sounded like he was talking about Iraq, and that it would not be over quickly, but it would take longer than World War One or World War Two. But he said he hoped it would be over before, in less time than the Cold War took. But this is a major operation, and of course he is very much on the inside and was one of the strong supporters for the war in Iraq.
He is a member of the Project for the New American Century, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and of course many members of PNAC are the CFR people. And the CFR is a front group for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created back in 1891 to bring about the New World Order. And if you doubt that, get the Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, pages 951 and 952. And he'll explain to you exactly where the CFR came from. And although they talk about the CFR so glibly today, nobody ever tells you its origin, a front for a secret society.
Very true. And, you know, the point you make, Dr. Stan, I think that it's a hard one for people to understand, but it's really the crux of this matter, and that this is not just a physical battle. This is a spiritual warfare that we're engaged in here. The forces are arrayed against us. It's a battle for men's souls and for the future of our country, which is really keyed to, has been keyed in the past, our success has been keyed in the past, to our belief system. That's what's on trial at the present time, and what the New World Order seeks to disrupt and put away and under earth, because they want to rule everything and take the place of God.
That's so true. In fact, Dr. Dennis Cuddy had sent me something the other day. It was written back in 1929. It was called The New World Order. It was a book about the New World Order. And it basically said that this was the idea of bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth. And man then, of course, substituting for God and creating this world utopia. 1919. Fascinating information. Of course, you're not going to see this mentioned in your textbooks. But this is, of course, this underlying, this continuity of thought, you know, between our intellectuals and our occultists. You'll find certainly Alice Bailey writing about this in the 1940s about the New World Order. And then, of course, H.G. Wells writing his book, The New World Order, in the late 1930s or early 1940s. And then, of course, the George Bush talking about this in September. In fact, it was September 11th of the year 2000. 1990, September 11th, 1990, when George Herbert Walker Bush first talked about the New World Order. But, of course, he was really talking about this same old world order that the occultists have been talking about since the beginning of time.
That's very true, and I think that it's very significant in the documents that have come out over the past year since 9/11 out of the new Bush administration, that they really don't mention the New World Order by name, in contrast to at the time of the Gulf War number one in 1991-1990, when President Bush back then made speech after speech talking about how this was really a victory for the New World Order and was introducing a new era of the success of the New World Order. And he repeated this over and over. Somebody counted them up, and I think they had 200 times that he mentioned it. And, of course, Henry Kissinger was mentioning it, and the other top officials as well. And there was a reaction to this, because people who understood what he was talking about, people such as yourself in particular, and other people that have followed the New World Order, started calling the people's attention to what was really happening. And they recognized that how counterproductive they're letting this cat out of the bag, so to speak, was becoming, and so they then went silent. And that's why you don't hear any of that today in the documents or see it there, Yet all the components are there, all the pieces, they all fit together, all the rhetoric is there except for that label, the New World Order.
Now, they actually call it the New International Order. That was the term that they used in the statement of principles of the project for the New American Century, a New International Order that will, of course, pursue our principles and our profits and our it was a whole new international order that we were going to impose on the world.
That's true, and in the national security strategy, George Bush refers to it as a distinctly American internationalism, putting the label of American on it. And so that will further confuse everybody, because if it's American, how can it be bad? But that's the same thing.
Because Americanism has nothing to do with creating a world government. American has nothing to do with dominating other countries. American has to do with limiting the power of the central authority and letting people be free. But are we bringing freedom to the people of the world? Well, you know, we say we want to free these people and give them a democracy. And then we say, of course, we're going to, of course, bring in the people that we think should be running the government. Isn't there some inconsistency in this? Did we bring democracy to Afghanistan after we got rid of the Taliban? No, we put in a man who was a consultant to UNICAL. His name was Karzai. He's now the dictator over there. Of course, they have this facade of democracy. There's no democracy in Afghanistan today. Did we restore democracy to Kuwait after the first Gulf War? No, we reinstalled the dictatorship there. They call it a monarchy, but it's a dictatorship. Call it what you will. We install these dictatorships throughout the world, and we keep them in power, as we're keeping Mubarak in power in Egypt. You know, where 99.4% of the people always vote for him. And if anybody believes that those are free elections, they're incredibly naive. We're, of course, keeping the Algerian military in power because the people voted for an Islamic fundamentalist movement. We didn't want that, so we backed the military there as they imposed a military dictatorship. But where is there any call for democracy in Algeria? The people there want an Islamic fundamentalist government. I think that they're very foolish, but they should have that right, or should they?
That's very true. And in this document, you have the same inconsistency. It's black and white in the same pages even. On one hand, they talk about that they want to promote American values and principles. They refer to it very specifically that way. And then they go on, and everything they say in terms of what they're going to do are exactly contrary to those values and principles. And so two of the things that are most notable is, number one, interfering with the internal affairs of other countries, which is certainly not among our traditional values and principles established by the Founding Fathers. And also, another thing that is promoted in those books are foreign entanglements, exactly the things that our first president told us to avoid, like the plague. And here George Bush is saying, well, we want to really increase the effect of all of these various organizations, the World Trade Organizations, the GATT, the NAFTA, the World Trade Centers. All of these, and the UN, of course, all of these foreign entanglements are just brought up almost every other page.
Well, you know, it's really very, very interesting. There's a lady named Barbara Lee. She was a congressman from one of the southern states, and when, of course, 9/11 occurred, she questioned whether the government was telling the whole truth. And because she questioned the administration, they got all the Republicans in her area to re-register Democrat, and they were able to defeat her in the Democrat primary, and she's out of Congress. But she's going across the country talking today to radical left-wing groups, and she's saying, look, the Bush administration is talking about rebuilding of the health care system in Iraq. They're talking about rebuilding the educational system in Iraq. And her plea was, what we ought to be doing is rebuilding the healthcare system in the United States and rebuilding the educational system in the United States and not be rebuilding this in countries throughout the world. We should not be nation building. Well, of course, I agree with the latter conclusion. I don't agree with the first one. The whole idea of our government was the federal government was never to have anything to do with education or agriculture or anything else. Its power to be limited by the chains of the Constitution, for our founding fathers knew that government governs best, it governs the least. So we're not only expanding the federal control over the lives of the people here in every aspect, we're also extending the control of our federal government over the lives of people in other nations throughout the world as we begin to redistribute the wealth of our people to build up the economy of the people of Iraq and the living standards of the people of Iraq after we destroy their nation. There's something wrong with this picture.
Of course, the education is key because the enemy has always seized upon education as the number one component that is necessary to create a totalitarian society. You have to have control over the people. You have to teach them what you want them to believe is the case, teach them what to think, not how to think. And the way you do that is through the education system. Of course, that is why we have the big push on putting federal money into the U.S. education. And the more federal money you have, the lower the standards in our educational system drop. The literacy rate was far higher 200 years ago than it is today, notwithstanding the billions of dollars that go into education at the federal level. Of course, this goes back again also to the great effect of the various tax-exempt foundations just shortly after the turn of the century to control the educational system so that they would be able to establish the agenda for both the foreign and domestic policy. And to do this, they had to take care of the college systems, the various policy centers around the country, and make sure that the people in the high schools were taught the right things, and the right things were what to think, not how to think. And they went into that effort very effectively, and by 1950 had accomplished it so well that there was a congressional hearing that was set up, a congressional investigation to look at the effect of all these tax-exempt institutions in undermining our own constitutional republic and changing it to a basis of communism or socialism or globalism or collectivism, all of which, of course, mean exactly the same thing.
And that was, of course, the REACH Committee, and, of course, that was written up in a book called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which we actually published. And if you, any of your listeners interested in understanding who really runs America behind the scenes, the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence is certainly one of the most important books in my library. Well, let me just quickly say somebody had called in and wanted to know who was behind the spontaneous, I want you to know that, peace demonstrations that are being held all over the world. Do you have a comment on that, Dr. Douglas?
Oh, I think, as I recall from a number of those organizations that have been looked at, that you find the same types of sponsorship as you did in the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, which sprung up spontaneously. And particularly if you look at the recent demonstrations in the United States, one of the major funding institutions came from the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches, which we know are communist front organizations. And they were contributing something like $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 to some of these riots on the West Coast, as I recall.
And I think that's absolutely right. Of course, the money that comes from the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches is, of course, tax-exempt money. You're paying for it with your donations to your church. But in addition to that, of course, I believe that there was a book written during the Vietnam War era. I think it was called The Strawberry Connection, pointing out how a young man was going to SDS meetings, finding that people were there from the great corporations, from Exxon and from the other big oil corporations, funding a lot of this. Why? Because, of course, they wanted the people to be able to vent their anger. It wasn't going to accomplish anything. But these demonstrations made people feel better as if somehow they were having an effect, whereas, of course, they would have absolutely no effect. And what they really did, of course, was many of the people being communists and radicals, they only tended to make anybody who opposed the war be acquainted with these radical people who hate America. And just as today, anybody who opposes the war is equated with Barbara Streisand and Martin Sheen. And you certainly wouldn't want to be associated with the Hollywood left, would you? And so don't you dare oppose what the imperialistic programs that are being put out today. Let's go to John, who's calling from Post Falls, Idaho. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hello there. Pretty good. Dr. Douglas, I was particularly struck by your statement earlier in the program that without people of integrity, quote, a constitution is not worth the paper it's printed on, unquote. And I have had this recent ongoing debate with friends and relatives about whether America is really at war or not in a constitutional sense. And I was really startled to get some rhetorical support Friday night from a most unlikely source. I don't know if you guys saw the McLaughlin Group, but Tony Blankley apparently said that we are not at war in a constitutional sense. And I thought this was a startlingly frank admission from a Washington insider. Of course, he was. We're talking about Newt Gingrich's former chief of staff here. So as I see it, Congress has quietly passed all these legally meaningless resolutions, and yet the votes apparently aren't there for a real declaration of war. And what we have with President Bush is basically a benevolent dictator. And I'd hasten to add, he, by all appearances, does appear to be a godly man. But I see trouble ahead. I tremble thinking about what the Clintons would do with us. But perhaps you could, Dr. Douglas, you could comment on Commander Spiker. The Commander Spiker episode is evidence of the low regard the Clinton administration had for our MIA POWs in general. And apparently he's still Saddam's prisoner of war. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think you're absolutely right on this, on the fact that we are not really formally at war. We're all we're doing is implementing a resolution as policemen for the United Nations. What is very curious about this is, you know, after 9/11, I believe it was the Speaker of the House who asked the President if he would like a declaration of war. He said, "No, you know, there's no question. You know, we'll give it to you. Congress will give it to you." And President Bush declined.
He
said, "No, we already have enough authority to do what we want to do. All we want to do is have you, you know, vote to give us the power, the money for the forces." And what struck me recently is I can see why he might want to do that. Because if you had a declaration of war, that would be probably geared right to responding to the attack by bin Laden and his troop of people there. But if you And thus you would have a declaration of war, which would put limitations on what you could do, which would be to respond to the attack by bin Laden. But when you look at the national security strategy, which is sets the tone for the whole war on terrorism, most of it is really directed toward furthering the aims of the New World Order, not fighting the war on terrorism. So I can understand why he would have turned that down. In the case of Commander, I guess it was Lieutenant Spiker, who... Right. A pilot who was lost on, I guess, the first day of the war back in 91. For a long time, he was considered killed in action. And it was only really at the result of some of his parents and other people who started getting information out that he was declared finally a POW. Now, that is not uncommon. Our administration has left behind deliberately and knowingly over 30,000 conservatively men who were captured as POWs and then abandoned at war's end. And that includes World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, and the Cold War. And what is perhaps worse about that is in the investigations that have gone on by, I'd say three or four dozen investigators, they've all found out the same thing, basically, which was that the people at the top of the administration, in all cases, knew that the men were that there were many men alive, yet they just turned their heads in the other direction, and then proceeded to cover up the fact that they had been lying about nobody being left alive after World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So it's really a deplorable situation, and Commander Spiker is certainly the latest example where that is true from the beginning of the Gulf War, and it would be very interesting, and we hope that they will actually uncover him, and I'm sure they're searching for him at the present time as they search for a number of other things in Baghdad there.
All right, fine. John, we're going to have to let you go because we're out of time, but thanks so much for calling. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Dr. Douglas, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners other than they should, of course, get your book, Betrayed, by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like information on how to get that, that's 1-800-544-8927.
Well, I think the parting thought that I like is one suggested here by Paul, and that goes back to John Adams, one of our founding fathers, who basically said, The Constitution was designed for a moral people. It will not work otherwise.
Amen to that.
And what we risk at the present time is seeing our Constitution undermined to the extent where it means less and less every year, and we are, as you can see, daily losing the moral basis of our country.
Amen to that. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. That was Dr. Joseph Douglas. It's very late at night back there, so we're going to let Dr. Douglas go. We've got a great program this next hour you won't want to miss. If you're, of course, listening to us on the Internet, if you're not, you need to get a computer so you can hear us regularly at RadioLiberty.com, 5 hours every day. And, of course, this is the time we just mentioned that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to become part of our team, if you believe we're entering World War III, if you believe we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you to pray for our boys over there in battle and for their families. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Stand here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We hope we're going to have with us our very, very special friend, John Loeffler. And John is an amazing, amazing individual. He and his wife and left the security of comfortable jobs working within the media well over a decade ago, and they moved off to Colorado, where John became the conservative voice of Denver and did a talk show there and really sort of looked to the Lord for support. And he was there for a good time. He was doing such a good job that, obviously somebody didn't like what he was saying. And so he was had to move up, and he moved up to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and worked there for a time with Chuck Missler. But he's always had his own radio program that's heard across America. It's called Steel on Steel. And, of course, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. We air it here on our station every Wednesday evening from 7 to 8. And if you don't listen to John, why you're missing one of the high points of the week. Always with a wonderful commentary and certainly the ability to crystallize ideas. And, of course, we're pleased to have him here as our guest this evening, Mr. John Loeffler. Hi, John.
Boy, that was an intro. I feel like there's a spotlight here, and, you know. Well, thank you, Stan. It's really great to be here, and I, you know, I'm out in the West Coast again, you know, that type of stuff.
Okay, fine. Well, Jill, anyway, Chris, it's great to have you with us. And, you know, these are such such really vital times, and it's so important that we have people who are talking to people across America by radio, because this is the only means we have of letting people understand that this is a spiritual battle and that God is in this battle. You can't divorce things that are going on from God's plan for mankind and perhaps using wars to punish nations that have turned against him. So give us your input, your take on what's going on today.
Oh, it's an interesting time to be doing news work. I think the most important take that I put together is I'm working on an article called Bullets, which is nothing but a series of bullets about observations I've made about this whole thing, because in the mainline media, even though on Fox and on all the conservative talk shows...
Well, now, you don't really believe that Fox is really conservative, do you?
No. I mean, that was Fox and the conservative Fox show.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
That wasn't all-inclusive. No, I don't. Fox isn't much different than all the others, to be honest with you. In other words, you can prove that just by punching around on the dial. But the issues that have been discussed are superficial, or they're discussed linearly, like it's either this or that. We're either going in to free the Iraqi people and save ourselves from terrorism, or we're going in because of oil, you know, that type of thing. and it was very amusing to me. I mean, having been in San Francisco in the late 60s when the Flower Child and the Peace Movement kicked in there and everything, to see these people come out of the woodwork as well. It's sort of like they're back, you know. And all of these are very superficial surface things, but in reality what's going on is what I call multiple dimension. There's that superficial one, which is we're saving the Iraqi people and we're defending ourselves from 9/11, which has really always been hard to justify because President Bush did such an absolutely bad job of linking up Iraq and terrorism. But there was an Iraqi connection. You know, Jana Davis showed that. Now her looks like she's got her lawsuit won, just more by default since the plaintiffs have backed out of it after 8 years of trying to get her to shut up about the whole Iraqi connection with that. The new book out by James Cashel, TW-800, of course, the evidence now that it was a terrorist event. And the funny part is that, you know, there really was an Iraqi connection, but the White House can't say that because there's an unwritten rule in Washington about not ratting on your fellow governmentarians, even if it was a previous administration. So they're letting it out through back channels. And that's that dimension of the war. What was there an oil dimension? Absolutely. You know, the study from the James Baker Institute. You know, they knew before we went into this thing that within about 10 years there's going to be a very severe oil crunch. And the very severe oil crunch, due not because there's a shortage of oil yet, we're probably not even quite halfway through the world's oil supply, but because we've been curtailing our means of exploration, largely due to radical environmentalism. That's the other factor. And as a result, just like with the power situation in California, we haven't been developing, you know, new methods of getting oil, and most of the cheap oil is gone. We're going to have to work harder to get it. So everybody sees this oil crunch coming in less than a decade. The Russians see it. We see it. It rarely came to the surface, but it was there. That's the next issue that's out there. The next dimension that's in there is the one we've you and Joe Douglas were talking about the last hour, and that's the whole globalist issue, that we knew the New World Order per se, and remember this whole thing originally was justified under the goal of the guise of the New World Order. We didn't think that up. That was something President Bush used, President Bush Sr., for hundreds upon hundreds of times to justify what we were doing. And suddenly we threw that overboard. We almost fired a shot across the bow of the United Nations and said, you're worthless junk anymore, and if you're not going to do it, we're going to do it. So there's all these multiple levels and dimensions. What most people I haven't heard talk about so far has been what all of this means. Okay, we've drawn a line in the sand. That's the first thing we did, and we've shown we're going to act on that line on the sand. This puts a lot of nations in the Middle East on notice. First of all, we're plopped right in the middle of the Middle East. I'm going to be predicting they're going to be rolling out the concrete real shortly, or at least moving into Baghdad Airport, and we'll see a new airbase there that is no longer dependent upon the whims of the Saudis or the Turks for being able to use their bases for different things. Countries like Syria are extremely nervous right now. At the same time, this move in and this defeat of Iraq will be seen by at least certain groups within inside Islam as an attack on Islam itself. Now, they can't hire a standing army and do all of that. So that means the only warfare left to them will be weapon of mass destruction and terrorist type of activity. So we can look forward to that. People are surprised that we haven't seen any terrorism yet. I'm not really, because after 9/11, you know, there's an interacting level here among all of this. The countries that support terrorism are likewise supported by large amounts of cash flow from the United States. And they sort of took it in the pocketbook when the economy buckled, at least in the name of the war on terrorism. So they're concerned as well. So you've got all these different, it's amazing all the amount of interactive things that are going on at the same time. And it's always discussed either or. Have you noticed that in the media? It's never discussed as a sort of a giant continuum of interacting events moving along a plane or a continuum type of thing, which is more a better model of the reality that's going on out there. There is one thing for sure. We've passed through a paradigm, and I don't think most of the people, even the pundits who have been covering the war, really comprehend what the rules of the new paradigm are.
All right, what are the rules of the new paradigm?
Well, like Indiana Jones, I don't know. We're making this up as we go along.
Well, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say first.
Yeah, well, James Woolsey said it. You know, he said, and James Woolsey and the former head of the Mossad have both said we're basically into World War III. Woolsey said World War IV. He counted World War III as the Cold War. I don't agree with that. This is just round one. You know, the battle for Helm's Deep is over, so to speak, and now the battle for Middle Earth has begun. It's an ongoing series of conflicts. If you buy into the dialectical process, then we know that we always have to have this conflict, otherwise people don't keep moving along the continuum toward the predetermined outcomes, which, if you look at, like, say, for the example, the things that we're intending to bring into Iraq, such as the thing Bill Bennett and some of his organizations have planned in terms of the new education, we're really importing not democracy, and I'll use that term in quotes, we know what we mean by it, rather than republicanism, so to speak. We're really bringing in a new form of socialism and dialectical thought. And I think the brave boys fighting over in Iraq now, I should say men and women, since we have a mix now, are going to be disappointed in 10 or 15 years to find out that everything we fought for has suddenly been hijacked and gone in a different direction. It always does under this dialectical process. The second thing is we're in a form of warfare where everybody's a legitimate target. You know, the war, I think I talked to Jaina Davis today, and she was pretty convinced. She said, given everything she now knows and the leak across the border, she says the number of sleepers in the country, we will have more events. But, of course, that is sort of what all the globalists have wanted all along. They just thrive on this chaos. There's just no doubt about it, because the chaos always gives us a chance to move people, you know, along. The next thing that's been interesting on this in terms of the new rules is that the rule of law has become very fuzzy. We hear international law quoted by people. Well, this war is illegal because the UN didn't sanction it. Well, who gave the UN the power to sanction anything, for that matter? And so we quote law or international law when it's convenient. We ignore it when it's convenient. We redefine it when it's convenient. We've also, I maintain that the Attorney General John Ashcroft has been busy running around putting demolition charges on the framework of the Constitution, which will come back to haunt us with a vengeance, because it's all dependent upon definitions. If we can define you as something, suddenly we can deny you all sorts of these rights. And since they'll point backwards in time and say, but back in the Bush administration, we set this precedent. And now that the precedent has been set, all we have to do is change the definition of what an enemy combatant is. What is amazing is the number of things in the last 2 years, since January 1st of 2000, that have been upended, turned over, switched around, changed, And I don't think most Americans have grappled with all of this, Dr. Stan, to be honest with you. They see us going through it, but they really don't understand the core issues that have changed.
Well, I agree with you totally. I don't think most people understand that we've entered World War III. I don't think most people understand that we will never know again during our lifetimes the America that we lived in before. And, of course, I agree with you that there's going to be more domestic terrorism, but that's always been planned. That's why, you know, they, back in 1993, took all the air marshals off of our planes. We had air marshals on our planes before 1993. How many people know that? I did an interview with a Dr. John Lott, who's written a great new book. It's called The Bias Against Guns. And he was pointing out that we had air marshals on our planes because during the 60s and 70s, we had a lot of hijackings. And so they put air marshals on the planes. And then about the time that they realized that Iran was actually teaching people how to hijack American planes, and they had camps over in Iran and where they actually had 747s and 707s, then our government, its wisdom, once they knew that those camps were there, we took the air marshals off of our planes. Why would we do something that stupid? Why? And incidentally, for documentation on that, it's Joseph Podansky's book. I believe it's Attack America, or something very similar. If you want the exact title, you can give me a call and I'll get it for you. That book is totally suppressed. You can't even get a copy of it in the United States anymore. Somebody's obviously bought those books up and they're just not around. A few universities have them, but the copies have disappeared. And then, of course, we know that in 1994, Stephen Emerson put out a video, which is called Jihad in America, and somebody suppressed that, kept it off of, kept it so it couldn't either be sold on video or it couldn't be shown on PBS. Why? Because they didn't want the American people to know that the Islamic radicals were actually training here in the United States and were being funded in large part from the United States in 1996. And you'll see this in Everson's book, The American Jihad, testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, telling how so much of Hezbollah and Hamas and the others were being funded by organizations in the United States.
Yeah,
they've known this all along. They've known that Saudi Arabia was financing this. They know that 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, that Osama bin Laden came from Saudi Arabia, that Saudis have continued funding Al-Qaeda long after 9/11. They were funding Hamas, or at least they were meeting with Hamas up until October of last year, according to the book Hatred's Kingdom, the story of Saudi Arabia. And yet, of course, they don't want the American people to know that. They've known every step of the way exactly what was going to happen, because at least according to the testimony by Kristen Breitweiser on the 18th of September last year, and we'll make copies of my October newsletter available to anybody, and it's Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, within two hours of the September 11th attack, the FBI was at the restaurants where the hijackers ate, at the schools where they trained, in the neighborhoods where they lived. How could they do that if they had no idea what was going to happen? And the answer is they couldn't if they had no idea what was going to happen.
Right, and by that time, I mean, how did we know who the pilots were even?
Right.
You know, I mean, you had airplanes full of people. How do they know which of the people out of all the passenger manifests were the ones who were the pilots on the airplane?
Well, of course, they rescued two passports, one of them from the World Trade Center and one of them from the plane that went down in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
If you can believe this, that out of this flaming inferno there at the World Trade Center, one of these passports flutters down to the ground.
Yeah, but I mean, how did they even connect it with the planes? I mean, how many passports were present in somebody's office in the World Trade Center?
And then, of course, somebody must have opened one of the windows on the plane in Pennsylvania because they actually had that picture up on the FBI website until somebody probably pointed out, you don't think the American people are really stupid enough to believe that, do you? And they took it down. But, you know, supposedly one of the passports from one of these wicked hijackers. Something's wrong with this whole thing, and we're sure not going to get the truth out of this current investigation.
No, you're not going to get the truth.
Well,
funniest thing about Stephen Emerson's Jihad in America, I talked to him after 9/11. That's when all of a sudden, after all the years of having it spiked by PBS, the PBS's rights to the video had reverted back to Emerson, and then they began selling like pancakes at a church picnic, you know, And all of a sudden, PBS came rushing back in saying, you know, maybe we better renegotiate this contract after they had suppressed the whole thing for over 7 years, Dr. Stan.
Well, I think the American people have to understand that that video was intentionally suppressed.
Right.
And this is how they control what we think. Had the American people seen that video in 1994, they would have demanded we do something about the radical revolutionary movement right here in the United States. And it's got pictures of a fellow named Azam, who leads this whole Islamic movement, talking about how we're going to have jihad in America, we're going to have blood running on the streets of America, how we're going to have to cut off hands and feet so that Allah will have legs to stand on.
Yep.
And you have to see, if you haven't seen that video, it's an amazing video. And you can understand why it was suppressed. And until the American people understand that there is thought control in America, it's very effective, and they're able effectively to control exactly what the American people think. In fact, the most amazing statistic I read, it's a little off the subject, but it's on this new disease that suddenly appeared out of China called SARS. I just love that, SARS. That's serious acute respiratory syndrome. You'd think that they could come up with a better term than that. But, you know, one day this last week, there were 5 articles in the Wall Street Journal on SARS. And, you know, then there was they actually did a poll of the American citizens, and about 38% of them believed there was far more danger from SARS than, you know, there was from terrorism. And yet, there's not been one death in the United States from this. We have over 30,000 people die in the United States every year from influenza. Not one death in the United States from SARS. And yet, of course, the people are terrified of it. Just goes to show you that maybe Barnum was right.
But you know what? You've actually answered the thing, Dr. Stan. You know, you were talking about until people realize. People historically don't realize it. And so that's why I've suddenly realized that we're pretty much committed to the course that we're on. And that's, I've started to take that realistically in my own thinking. What I'm most disgusted with is the so-called conservative media, which, you know, if anybody has voiced even what I call reasonable questions about what's going on, they have been ridiculed and whatever. Everyone is, including the religious right media, where everybody's supposed to walk in lockstep, yell Heil Bush and praise Jesus because he's coming soon, you know, that type of thing. And that's been sort of the thing. And I would have put the onus of truth heavily on that media, especially the religious media. But I've been really disappointed and let down. So for me, it's been a very clear-cut compass. I understand what the future will look like, and I'm cutting a course accordingly, you know, in terms of directing my own show and things of that nature. But I don't think we're going to alert anybody to this. If the questions were raised along larger media, if O'Reilly were doing that every night, and Hannity and Combs and these people, then we would see some reaction to it. But the questions are never raised, and all of the issues that are discussed are sort of trivial in my mind compared to what we know is going on.
Well, you're absolutely right, and all we can do is with what we have, of course, with the Internet, you know, more and more people are listening to the Internet programs because they know they're not going to get the truth off the major media. The trouble is that even many of our Internet programs, even many of our Internet networks are going right along with this because, after all, God somehow must be in this whole thing. It's a fight between good and evil, and good, God's got to be on our side, and against the evil, which is Saddam Hussein. And I simply asked a reply, well, if that may very well be true, but who kept Saddam Hussein in power all these years? Who allowed him to smuggle oil? Who kept him in power after the 9/11 attack? Find me after the Gulf War, who allowed him to put his helicopters up and kill all the Shiites and the Kurds, and who backed him after he used poison gas on the Iranians in 1988, who provided him with all the funding that he had, and who blocked efforts by the Saudi military in 1993 and 1995 to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And reference for all of this, I've said, is in an excellent book called See No Evil, which is available through Radio Liberty. If any of you are out there and want to document what I'm saying, that's See No Evil by Robert Baer. You need to get the book. You need to read it. And in fact, we actually quote much of this in my latest newsletter right from the book. But you see, until people begin asking the questions instead of defending their position, why we never get any place. And I believe asking a question is far better than trying to tell people things. Because I don't think they want to hear. Their mind is already made up. Their mind is controlled by the images they've seen on the screen. And the only way to break that thought control that is so effective in America today is by asking questions.
Yeah, and what everybody needs to understand is we are coming out of a period where the good times rolled through the 90s. And if you've noticed, it was interesting, on one of the other shows I work on, somebody objected to the point that I raised, that I said, you remember the peace movement? I said, well, they're back. And it's usually a lot of people who are, you know, have certain convictions this way or that way about peace. But remember that the peace movement in the 60s was well-funded by the communists. It was a chief weapon of theirs. So you had a lot of people being played for dupes in the course of this whole thing. As a matter of fact, the whole peace movement probably more than anything else prolonged the Cold War far longer than it needed to have gone on, because the communists played off of that sentiment within the United States to constantly be achieving, you know, some kind of a compromise into a treaty or something which they never fulfilled. So we've entered this whole paradigm. And I'm not sure that people here, it's like deer caught in the headlights. Everyone that I speak to on the street is still in the old paradigm, is still seeing things through the old filter, trying to get back to the good times that rolled in the 90s, not aware of where it's coming or what it will demand of them in the future. And that's where we're going to get caught short more than anything else, is in the failure to be able to grapple with that.
Well, you know, your comment about the peace movement, during the Vietnam War, let me just explore that, because I think that's really so effective. First of all, I was certainly very pro-war during most of the Vietnam War. And, of course, we see these people demonstrating against the war. And we know, of course, the communists are on that, involved in that. And so we equate these people with communists and, these people are so short-sighted. And yet, looking back on what happened and the realization we never went to Vietnam to fight communism, if you've read the rules of engagement, which incidentally we now have, and we will make them available to our listeners, although we'll have to, of course, ask for a donation because they're fairly, I think, they're about 40 pages in length at the Congressional Record, you realize we didn't send our boys there to fight communism. We sent the boys there as a diversion. And, of course, we financed the North Vietnamese all during the war. So maybe the peace demonstrators were right for the wrong reason. In other words, some of them, of course, really wanted America to lose, and that's that is unconscionable. But for the people who saw the futility in the war, maybe they didn't understand that we were financing the North Vietnamese. Maybe they didn't understand that we weren't there to fight communism. But they were right in opposing the war. And just as today, many of the same people are out demonstrating for peace, they don't understand who's kept Saddam Hussein in power all this time. And it almost, the things that are happening are almost scripted, as if somebody had been planning a long time ago to use this incident at this time in history to further this goal, the New World Order, the New World Religion, because I think that most people who analyze this don't look beyond the obvious at the spiritual component of what's going on behind the scenes. And I think that's where the real key to this whole thing is. And the question should be asked in all of this is, where is God? Where is Satan? Where are his disciples? What are they doing? And what should God's people really be doing?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I had a discussion with our contact in London.
Our mutual contact there?
Huh?
You mean Chris?
Yeah, okay. I mean Chris, right.
Okay.
And Chris and I were talking, and I was talking about the editor of the magazine that he's at, and I said, it's always interesting when I'm talking to you or to the editor here, because you have two different worldviews involved in this thing. And I said, it's always interesting to watch the difference. And I said, the Christians start from the end and reverse engineer. They go back to the beginning. The unbelievers, who have no idea where we're going, the future is a big, dark, you know, secret that nobody seems to know. And if we don't watch it, we're going to botch it up, and we have to rescue it all of ourselves. They're working it forward. And that's why the difference between the two. In other words, if we look at the scriptures say very clearly that there will be certain things, a whole plethora of signs that will accompany the end times, because these times would be some of the more radical, and people would have to know about these to keep their faith intact, among other things like that. We've always known there would be some form of global government. We've known that there would be some form of international, universal codification of human beings. We've known that. The mark of the beast, that's what that is all about. That it would be an economic symbol. We knew that there would be tremendous amounts of inflation. The Bible says, until the end there shall be war. In other words, when it talks about all these times. So we know that there never will be peace. This whole peace movement that was always, everybody, it seems so elusive. And every move towards peace always contains within it a lie and the seed of its own destruction. But that only becomes obvious after decades of fighting and struggle and everything else like that. And so we've known all of these things. That's why we have an insight, which is why none of this makes me too terribly nervous. Even if I have to die in the middle of it, I still understand where I am, where I'm coming from, where I'm going.
Oh, but don't you want to see how it all ends up?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I mean, that's the fun part. You know, you want to see where it all ends up.
Of course, yeah. I'm sure that when you're in heaven, you know, if you do not make it through, why, at least you can look down and see how it's playing out. And this is the one consolation we have that the rest of the people don't have.
Excuse me. I just gagged on something.
Oh,
sorry.
Oh, well, my goodness. I hope that they're not beaming rays or something in there.
No, it's more like taking some herbal supplements okay. while I'm on the air.
Maybe it's SARS, you know, that new one. Well, anyway, of course, I agree with you totally. And it's just a different world perspective. And, you know, it's very interesting. I'm going to be talking at a conspiracy conference in Santa Clara on the Memorial Day weekend. We'll get a little plug-in for it. If anybody's interested in knowing more about it, their website is conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracycon, C-O-N, for conference.com. Or you can call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. But I've been actually interviewing a number of the people from this conference on our program here. You know, get the information out, and it's amazing how many of these people are coming from an atheist or a non-believer's point of view. And of course, they have a completely different interpretation. They know there's a conspiracy, but they can't understand it. And of course, they have sort of a hopeless feeling of hopelessness. And if we're going to have to rely completely on our own efforts, why, we're doomed to failure, that's for sure.
Well, you know, that's the way a Christian sees everything is. I watch some really interesting dialogues among Christians, whereas some of them tend to see, you know, that everything is spiritualized. Others don't like to give Satan his true role. But if you read clearly in the scripture, it says that, you know, basically our enemy, the devil, roams about the world like a prowling lion.
We're going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be back in just a moment with John Loeffler here at the Radio Liberty Network. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Loeffler. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you don't have to be bashful. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And the point John was making, I think, is so vitally important. I hear people saying, oh, you know, the devil is God's devil, and, you know, he controls the devil, and everything the devil does, God allows him to do it. And I really believe that is probably in some ways true. But people don't want to acknowledge the fact that the evil reigns here in this world. This is the devil's world. And of course, he's controlled the governments of this world, going back to the time when Jesus was on the Mount of Temptation and said to the devil, the devil said to him, if you simply fall down and worship me, I can give you all the kingdoms of this world. It's about time people realized how powerful the devil really is. And now, of course, he's moving, making his final move towards establishing his kingdom here on earth. Well, I'm just going to pick up a call. Let's see who this is. Who's calling in?
Rose from New York.
Hi. Well, Rose, we haven't heard from you for a long time. How are you?
Good. I've been listening. I have a question that you touched on, that SARS. A while in the recent past, I remember reading about some scientists going over to Spain and digging up a body that died in some major flu epidemic for which there was no cure.
That was an influenza for the 1918 epidemic, and actually it wasn't just Spain, as I recall. Maybe
Italy?
John can correct me, but it was up in the tundra, and whether it was in Finland or whether it was in Iceland, I'm not sure whether...
Yeah, it was one of these. They had died, and they knew the body would have been preserved in the permafrost so they could hope to harvest samples. If it were in a temporal climate, the body would have decomposed along with most of the virus and everything like that.
They,
so.
They wanted, of course, to get the genetic codes for that so that supposedly if this lethal influenza ever came back again, that they would have treatments or they would understand it. Was that the agenda, or was this a genocidal agenda? And I would like to suggest there really is a genocidal agenda out there.
Well, I recall Joyce Riley talking about someone being on the early morning shows and referring to the SARS as, you know, people were worried about the epidemic as it was back during that flu. And it just struck me that, you know, what did they do with this virus that they dug up?
Well, nobody wants to. They're storing it right where they stored the anthrax that got out and seemed to have killed five people on the East Coast. You cannot, unfortunately, trust some of these people, some of these scientists, because, of course, they have no moral conscience. And all you need to do is this latest series of interviews we did on Bluebird, which was how they actually contracted with psychiatrists to create mental disease in patients. This was, of course, the efforts of our CIA. If people who haven't read Bluebird need to read it. And they not only, of course, have all the records in the CIA, they even published many of these articles in peer-reviewed journals in the 1960s and early 70s on how they created mental disease for profit here in the United States at the behest of the CIA. Well, if they would do that, does anybody think they wouldn't create new diseases that would eradicate large parts of our population? What are your thoughts on that, John? Is that too far out, maybe? Is that I sound almost on the verge of conspiracy or, you know, are people a little paranoid?
You know, the interesting issue that people, whenever I hear this whole debate over conspiracy theories, the issue is not, is it a conspiracy theory? The issue is it true? That's the question you ask, okay? And it seems like Americans have been accustomed to knee-jerking to that. You know, anytime you try to present an agenda that may be being forwarded, well, that's conspiracy theory. I mean, now, you have to look at the alternative. Does that mean that everything going on inside governments and private organizations all happens by random chance? Nobody's planning anything? Nobody's trying to forward certain laws and beliefs and ideas and regulations and achieving things? I mean, that's the only alternative to that whole thing, you know? And they never think all of that through to see where this whole thing is going. The second thing that Marilyn Ferguson always talks about in the areas of conspiracy, and she was an insider, that was her book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, is the fact that it's not a bunch of people in smoke-filled back rooms with green visors under a naked light bulb. These are very people who, for the most part, Dr. Stan, have been very open about what it is they want to do. When Strobe Talbot talks about forwarding global government, he's talking about forwarding a global government, for Pete's sake. Take him at his word.
And I think when Jacques Cousteau talks about the necessity of killing 350,000 people a day, as he did, and any of our listeners, it's amazing how often I've said, you just give us a call and we'll send you free of charge a copy of his article from UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, and nobody ever calls to get that. It's almost as if that is just too absurd, or if it is true, I don't want to know it. But that's what Jacques Cousteau wrote in the November 1991 issue of the UNESCO Courier, where it's going to be necessary to eliminate 350,000 people a day to bring the world back into balance. There really are people out there who feel that way, Rose, and unfortunately most people don't want to think about it. Is SARS genetically engineered? I think it's interesting. It came out of China. And, of course, the explanation is with a lot of chickens in China, a lot of ducks, and they have viruses, and maybe those viruses got into pigs, and maybe the pig viruses got into human beings, and that's obviously where it came from, because there's so many ducks and chickens and pigs in China and so many people. That's why all these things come out of China. Or the alternative is, are we using that as a laboratory to experiment with all of these terrible, terrible diseases that are planned for humanity by disciples of the dark side? Anything else, Rose?
No, that's it. It's just that it struck me, you know, just coincidence or what? You know, was this the same virus or Was it, you know, as you say, genetically engineered from it?
We don't know. And
I
don't know anybody who has the capacity to get hold of this. The SARS virus, which is just like a cold virus, only much more lethal. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got Nathan calling in. Hi, Nathan. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, before I get to my main point, you just hit a hot button of mine as far as the SARS issue. You know, I've been wondering about this from the very beginning. You know, I don't very little what I know about it, but I do know that it is very convenient that, well, you know, I mean, I have studied something about the depopulation issue. It's obviously something I don't know as much about as you do, Doctor, but the problem now is that I just wonder about everything. Anyhow, my main point for your guest, Mr. Leffler, or is it Dr. Leffler?
No, Mr. is good enough.
All right. Well, my main point is you hit on another hot button of mine, which is this concept of people, they try and deny a conspiracy, but, you know, there are all kinds of people who have come across it. Some of their viewpoints I find reprehensible and would never try even not to quote from them. But, you know, there are so many different ideological perspectives, people on the left, people on, I guess you could say, the right.
Right.
That how on earth... people who are well-researched, such as yourself, how is it, in your opinion, that despite this plethora of evidence, that the establishment is, or whatever you want to call the people who are able to keep control, how is it that they're able to keep this solely and completely out of the mainstream media? What possible mechanisms do they use to keep the vast majority of people from being aware? I mean, it seems to me like it's staring people playing in front of their faces. Is it their mind control, hypnosis?
You know, you don't even have to go to those levels. The media are basically, it's a very limited number of people in media who every day determine what the entire country will read and hear in the newspapers or on the radio and television. And again, if you have the common-minded myth that a number of people are actually steering things in certain directions. You know, look at, like you talked to Jaina Davis about what she had to do to try to get certain things into the mainline media and how they suppress that. See, some people just have certain biases. Bias is driving a lot of the media. And so if they have a bias against exploring certain things, say, for example, look at the Reed Irvine's commentary in the Wall Street Journal's commentary on TWA 800 and the fact that the New York Times lost the biggest story, the biggest scoop right under its nose, right in its own territory, by simply going with the government story on what happened with TWA 800, even though the more they did it, especially that idiotic CIA video they put together, the more absurd it became, and despite all of the other evidence. In other words, they weren't doing it. So as long as you have certain biases, you don't need to, quote, control it. It'll just never make it on the air. Now, there is a certain amount of control. I mean, we have numerous stories, if we just didn't dig too far, where we could find where stories were deliberately spiked, even though they were known to be true, and they had core issues and values involving the story. So a lot of it is bias. A lot of it is understanding that people want to have certain outcomes out of the media nowadays. How
people
is
meaning
it
the people who control or the people who are the readers?
Pardon?
The readers want a certain outcome, or more of those who own the media?
No, the people who are in control are largely radical left. They're actually further left than the mainstream left. They believe that the purpose of media is to shape the belief systems of the readers rather than to provide information. It was a radical change. Almost all of the journalism schools are controlled by people who have this radical left socialist mentality.
Or globalist, let's say.
And so, therefore, no conservatives, for the most part, need apply. And, you know, there are very few real conservatives writing in the media. There are some out there, but there aren't a large bucket of them. They're rather limited. And you have almost a controlled debate. In other words, there are politically correct conservatives, and they're allowed to voice their opinions, but they've never been allowed to get in the way of the general progression of things. That's never been allowed. So that's sort of the bias that you have going there. For example, how is it the Monica Lewinsky story broke? I mean, Newsweek had the story. He was going to go with it, and they spiked it because it would make the Clinton administration look bad.
Who ran with it? Matt Drudge, this obscure guy running a little website, remember?
Yeah.
And that's how the thing broke. And then for ages, they tried to poo-poo it. You know, he wasn't a professional. He wasn't a journalist. He didn't really break the story first, you know, this type of thing. Finally, they had to eat crow on all of that one because it became obvious that the new internet newspaper industry was starting to run circles around him. It really became embarrassing to the Washington Post, for example, when the London Telegraph was reporting all sorts of stuff on the Clinton administration, and the conservative talk show host, this is before we all had real active internet, the conservative talk show hosts were having friends in London fax some pertinent stories from the London Telegraph every day so they could use it on their radio shows. And it was proving a profound embarrassment for the Washington Post, who finally wrote an article attacking Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who is the correspondent in Washington for this, you know. Pritchard just did his job. He investigated what was going on. And I remember talking to him, and he said, you know, he really was very pro-Clinton when he came to Washington, and the more he investigated, the less he liked. But at least he had the integrity to report what was going on.
Yeah, and they got rid of him, too. They said, well, he'll be covering Europe, you know. But yeah, he did a wonderful job, and a wonderful, really amazing amount of material he did, put together on the Oklahoma City bombing.
And I remember that I was just, you know, I was always calling my friends in England saying, get me this story from the Telegraph and fax it to me, would you? You know, that type of thing. I'd hear about it or something.
Right.
So, and nowadays with the internet, it's become even harder to do it. But there is sort of what is called the credible media. It's harder to hold the lid on, which is why I've wondered how the globalist crowd if someday want to get this under control, which is what makes me very nervous about efforts to, you know, even to deal with porn on the net. As soon as we begin allowing some kind of regulation, European-type governments would love nothing better than to shut down criticism. They just have never dealt with it. They don't have the same commitment to freedom of the press that we do or have had. In Canada, Canada's pretty, you know, it's very hard to get stories out of Canada because, first of all, I don't think the Canadians care as much as we do. That's just my observation. And second of all, if you ever watch the CBC, it's like nothing. It's sort of equivalent to a bland form of national public radio here. And so it's very hard to find out what's actually going on. In the U.S., it's actually a big fight right now. It's pretty hard to spike it. But I will say this much. Newsmax seems more and more every day to be lining up with the politically correct right establishment rather than being cutting edge. To be honest with you, I find much more usable news copy, number one, from the intelligence subscriptions online like Stratfor and James and whatever that you pay for, and also from some of the think tanks and other independent agencies than I really do from the newspapers. Occasionally, like today, I just ran across a terrific story which ran in the London Telegraph. Whole new big study has been done that shows that temperatures in the Middle Ages were warmer than they are today. And this is putting a very serious crimp in this whole global warming thing, which right now has been wounded rather badly. People are backing out of the Kyoto Treaty, which wouldn't do anything anyway, even if we were going to warm up 100 degrees in the next century, you know, and that type of stuff. So you have to hunt, and you have to know how to read and compare stories. You know what it's like, Dr. Stan. I mean, after a while, you have to read this story and that story and this story, that story, and you go, okay, this story's propaganda, this story's sort of onto it, this story compared to that, and after a while, you can sort of figure out what's going on. But it takes a lot of reading. You can't just read one publication and expect to do it. And who of the populace are going to do that?
Well, I think that, John, really, I believe there's a spirit of blindness out there. I believe that the people's minds have been controlled to the point where if you raise a question as to what's going on, for instance, you were to show them the material from the Project for a New American Century, what the other side had written, they would look at you and say, you believe there's a conspiracy. You know, of course, I'm not going to have anything more to do with you. You must be a virtue or something. They could see the evidence right before them, And they would, of course, not be able to see the evidence right before them. And that is the big problem we have, because they've been working at this for years to learn how to control the minds and reality of the American people, and they've got this thing down great. In fact, I see Tex Mars is offering a new book by Jim Keith. Of course, Jim Keith died under very mysterious circumstances, as did the editor who publishes his material. I wonder how that coincidence should have happened. And we see so many strange deaths among people who are knowledgeable about what's going on today. And I can think that back through the years, a number of the people that I've interviewed who've met very, very strange deaths. Does this happen by accident? I don't think for 1 minute. I mean, we've carried this book by a former deputy director of covert operations for the CIA, where he openly bragged in his own papers about how they killed people. The CIA kills people who get too close to the truth. 109 people who knew something about the Kennedy assassination died under mysterious circumstances.
Right. And that violates the norms of statistical morbidity. Okay, that just you've skewed this curve, and because of that, just that alone statistically means that it was not a random event, Dr. Stan.
Right.
Okay, I mean just alone that just can't happen, you know. So.
Well, we live in exciting times. What's that old Chinese proverb? May you live in exciting times, and we certainly do.
And more of it to you.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We lost Nathan. I guess he felt that maybe we'd answer this question, or we weren't going to get back to him. I was going to get back to him and ask him if he had anything else to say, but I really think that the problem is that there is a spiritual blindness of the American people, and I believe God or maybe the dark side has created this. I only hope, of course, it's something you say or I say or maybe nothing that we say at all. Maybe God will intervene to let people begin to see the truth, or maybe as it has happened in so many other societies, people will not see the truth until our society has been destroyed and they're going under tremendous suffering. At that point, perhaps, they'll understand the significance of what's going on.
Well, you know what? It's interesting you say that, because I'll tell you why. Everybody in America forgets that, and this is what happens to a people. I was just reading through the Old Testament how the Israelites used to keep drifting from the Lord as generations would wear forward. Everybody would take the good times, and they would assume that was the norm. You know, we did have some prosperous years in this country as we were growing, when freedom was guarded and things of that nature. And everybody here in the West always assumes that this is the norm, this is the way it always is. It's just naturally this way, because they themselves have never experienced anything in any other way. They forget that throughout the history of mankind, just the reverse is true. It's a history of a lot of suffering, a lot of oppression, a lot of persecution, and that the freedoms that we have had are not the norm, they're a fluke, and they have to be carefully guarded. So, for example, when you say that, well, like I said earlier in the program, that I think John Ashcroft is damaging the Constitution, possibly irreparably, once we see how these things play out in future generations, they look at where we are now. They can't see that. In other words, they don't see it around them. They're still free and whatever. But they don't understand that the moral and emotional and physical and legal structures that have guaranteed that freedom have been badly damaged. Remember the World Trade Center? Everybody knew there was trouble. There was smoke coming from the upper floors and everything. Nobody dreamed it would collapse, Dr. Stan. Okay? It just took everybody by absolute shock when it happened. And right down to the last second, everything looked okay, aside from the problem that was up there, the smoke coming from the upper stories, etc. They knew there was crisis, but the rest of the building was okay. And all of a sudden, the whole thing came down. And that's the way it is typically in the changes, the paradigm changes that any society go through. The changes come over a period of time through a period of erosion and rotting away of the structure. But everything sort of looks and feels to those people. Until all of a sudden, kaboom, and down it comes. You know, it's real instructive to realize that at the end of World War II, there were still Germans trying to figure out what had happened. They literally could not understand what had happened. They knew they had seen the results of it, but they still failed to understand the philosophical and paradigm changes that had occurred that had caused it. The church itself was still trying to figure out what had happened. You know, if you take out of, 14,000 Protestant pastors in Germany at the time, only about 4,000 didn't join the German Christian Church, the Germanified version. They thought Hitler and Germany and all this stuff was a good thing. And out of that group, a much smaller number stood for anything. So there's an old rule of thumb I've established, and that is if they didn't see it coming, they won't know what to do when it gets here.
Is that a Lefflerism?
That's a Lefflerism.
All right, let's go to Tony from SoCal here before we run out of time. All right, is this Tony from SoCal?
Yeah, it's me.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stan.
Hi.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Yeah, in fact, I just joined your $6 a month MP3 thing yesterday.
Another victim.
Yeah. Well, just listening in on Wednesday from 7 to 8 just doesn't seem to be enough. So. But I've got a question for you. I don't know if I'm offline or not, but or just maybe goofy. But it seems to me that, if you can just follow my line of or train wreck of thinking here for a minute. World War One led the League of Nations. That failed. And according to Carol Quigley's friend Zimmer, led to World War II, gave us the UN. And now we've got the UN, and it seems like there's a heck of a lot of animosity going towards it, and a lot of people are thinking it's falling apart, nada, nada, nada. And I'm just wondering if maybe this is maybe an end run in order to give us a new and more powerful UN.
Right. That's what I've been saying on my show. We're either going to see the collapse or the radical reformation of it. That's exactly what's happening. That flag went up, I would say, almost 6 months ago. And I remember I called you, Dr. Stan. I called Dr. Cuddy. Constance Cumby, I called everybody I could think of and said, talk me out of this, okay? But there's something radically just changed here. All of a sudden, instead of being all in this global consensus, we have just fired a shot across the bow of the United Nations. And I said, there's a paradigm, there's a split now that has occurred in these things. Now, where it's going to wind up, I don't know. We do know it'll wind up in some globalist organization. We do know right now the UN, as it is a non-functional organization. It's dysfunctional. So whatever dream they have for this new unified global oneness vision, the UN in its current form can't provide it.
But do you think perhaps what we're seeing is the dialectic, and out of this thesis and this antithesis will come a new and stronger synthesis, which will be a more effective United Nations?
Right, that's what I think. And it may not even be called the United Nations. In other words, it might be allowed to collapse out, but probably not. But we're going to have to remake it. See, the UN wants to get into Baghdad here, you know. Now, and so do the French. I've never seen rats trying to get back onto a sinking ship. This is one of the more interesting, this is, you know, eek, 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 sploosh. Now it's sploosh, eek, 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 eek. They want back on. And I thought, oh, shove that. But you're right. There are giant dialectical processes in motion. And most people, Stan, do not understand the dialectic, despite the fact that it was the core dynamic of the 20th century. They don't believe it exists. They don't believe people prosecute it. And because of that, they get caught up in the ebb and flow of the back and forth, rather than realizing they're moving forward in a different direction. Yeah, to a predetermined outcome.
Amen to that. Anything else, Tony?
Yeah, this is kind of a little bit different subject altogether. It has to do with SARS. And these military KC-135 spraying tankers that, you know, seem to spray us almost every day around here. There is a citizens group of Ohio that's been making a lot of noise about these military KC-135 fueling tankers that leave these trails through the sky almost every day. And one thing I noticed is that, and it's not just me, but whenever they do a lot of this heavy aerial spraying, people come down with upper respiratory problems and coughing and sneezing and allergies and headaches, and they've got to go to the emergency rooms and get antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now SARS is coming out, and, you know, it seems like we've had about 15 cases or something like that in the country, and President Bush has just signed some sort of big order now that where they can quarantine people who've been infected and people who may have been exposed. They can be physically quarantined.
Well, I can see if there's all this money to get 15 cases. If they're trying to get 15 cases of SARS in America, then they're not doing a very good job. I think that when they use the spraying, they will have disastrous effects.
I just wondering if John thinks that there may be a link to all this, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, there is. I haven't established it yet, but it does raise what I call the Global Anxiety Index, the GAI.
All right, fine. Somebody wants to know a subscription, how they can get in touch with you, how they can get your material.
Well, they can, if they want to do an online subscription, they can listen online if they go to steelonsteel.com. That's the steel like the metal, steelonsteel.com. If they're interested in the monthly tape subscriptions, either the full subscription or the best program of every month, they can call us toll-free at 1-800-TAX-JOHN, 1-800-829-5646. Besides, this whole SARS thing is just a plot by the physicians to make more money. We know that.
Well, you know, whatever it is, you know, I'm concerned about the chemtrails, and I will tell you that they are putting out disinformation on this. I've heard repeatedly from various sources across the country, the government's explanation is they're giving us vaccines, oral nasal aerosol vaccines to help us. I think that someday, of course, we're going to find out that there's a different agenda, but I think right now it's a big experiment to find out where these clouds are going to drift to. And when they know that, and when the time comes in God's providence, why, there, I believe some terrible, terrible, terrible things are going to happen. John, we're just about out of time. Do you have a quick parting thought for our listeners?
Well, you know, I've never, we've gone through rough times before. There's always life. In the end, everybody dies. And so having yourself oriented to, I mean, even the bad guys die, if there are bad guys. And so having yourself orientated towards God and your purpose while you're here is important, and also understanding God's promise that he always takes care of those whom he loves while we're en route, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what happens to us.
Lo, I will be with you always, even unto the end of the world.
Indeed. And so it's not a cause for fear and panic. As a matter of fact, Jesus said, when you see these things, lift up your head, for your salvation draws nigh. So.
That's the sort of wonderful, wonderful hope that we can offer our listeners. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us, John.
It was good, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. And, of course, I hope you enjoyed our program with John. And, of course, this is the time we ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers and for our boys overseas and for their families and for the citizens, for the basically the people over in Arabia as well. They're all human beings, everyone made in the image and likeness of God, Muslim, Jew, Christian. You know, all we can do is hope and pray for them and hope they'll come to eventually to a personal relationship with our Lord. So until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Great show. Well, you know, nothing very profound, but a lot of good ideas. Joe's an excellent person. I always enjoy having
him. Hi there.
Hi.
He's
got them all done,
except about these few envelopes.
Oh, okay. That's great.
So,
yeah, and I like the wrap-up at the end.
Well, that's what we have.